Before we begin the lecture, I've just got two quick announcements. The one is for anybody who's attending the extra program, which is the free DVD and documentary program running supplementary to summer school. It's taking place in this building today and tomorrow, not moving back to the new economics building, so it'll take place either in 2B, which is down a passage, or in this lecture theatre. So the lunchtime ones are here, and the rest of them are in 2B. So check the program if you're interested in attending that. And the other thing is that those of you who are UCT alumni should have received an invitation to a lecture on Saturday by Professor Francis Wilson. So if you haven't, you need to come and collect the invitation from our offices on level 3. Okay, that's fine. Thanks.
Thanks, Janet. Thanks very much. You are an enormously privileged group of people today. Of course, this is the first time the two words mammal atlas have been spoken about in any sort of this is not the official launch of the project. This is part of getting it started. We probably won't launch until sometime in the second half of the year. So we now have the funding. At this point in time, we cannot disclose where the funding is going to come from. Got it. We've appointed Tully Hoffman as a postdoc to run with this project that we've launched. Off the ground, keep it going. And I think we're all excited to hear Tully's vision for the project. I guess a fair number of you have sons or daughters who've left school, done one thing, ended up doing something else. If Tully falls in that category, everything she's done between leaving school, even at school, and getting her PhD on human conflict, everything has contributed to building this sort of person that Tully is. And I hope that your sons and daughters likewise try various things in them. Finally found their niche. All those things work together. And, I hope Tully will tell us something about her route to getting the course and what she wants to say. So wherever you see things about baboons on the Cape Peninsula in the past year, it's Tully who's played a really large role in collecting the data related to that. So she moves on to a new challenge now. Thanks, Tully.
As tall as everyone else. Thanks, Les. It's always interesting for me how he lands up introducing me. Generally, he starts by telling people that I went to the National School of the Arts to study drama for high school, which is why I've shown such a diversion coming to biology. But I suppose for me, my passion has always originated, has always been with animals. And I'm unlike people, most people from the ADU, in that for me an animal, probably because I grew up surrounded by dogs, but for me an animal is something with fur and warm blood. So it's unsurprising for me that I've landed up now coordinating projects on mammals. Is there somewhere we can turn the front lights on? Okay. So, why a mammal atlas? We've probably been hearing all week that if you want to manage and conserve animals properly, you really have to understand their spatial distributions. And unfortunately for mammals... Do you want to turn down the lights? No, just the front with it, so they can see the slides a bit better. Oh. Is that fine? Can you speak in the slides? Okay, that's perfect, thanks. Unfortunately for mammals, our understanding of their spatial distribution is really based largely on historical records, or for some species, just complete best guesses. So if we really want to conserve mammals better, we actually have to understand their spatial distributions and what's driving those spatial distributions. And that's what we're trying to achieve with the mammal atlas at the ADU. Now, it's a fair question to ask why the mammal atlas hasn't been done already. And specifically why it hasn't been done by the ADU, who clearly are very good at Atlas projects. And the reason is quite simple. We had to wait, unknowingly, for technology to catch up with our mammal tracking enthusiasm. And the piece of technology we were waiting for was this. It's called a camera trap. I've got one here, so they range in size. This is quite a small one. But they tend to be quite small pieces of equipment now. And the way they differ from cameras, well, they're similar to cameras in that they have a lens, batteries, flash, but they differ in that they're remotely triggered. You no longer have to be standing there with your camera taking the photo. They're all now equipped with different kinds of triggers, be it a motion trigger, an infrared trigger, or a light beam trigger, which means you can leave your camera somewhere that you want to track animals, walk away, and your camera takes the photos for you. So camera traps aren't a new idea. In fact, they were pioneered by George Shiraz in the 1890s. He was an enthusiastic photographer, and he used to build his own cameras. He typically took photographs at night. He had a tripwire camera and a flash bulb. So every time an animal bumped into the tripwire, it would set off the flash. And the flash was so bright that it would temporarily blind both the photographer and the subjects. And it was so loud that George became renowned for these wonderful images of startled deer. So, in fact, his entire portfolio is kind of made up of those sort of photographs. Another person around the same time, so also in the 1890s, was Frank Chapman from the American Natural History Museum. And he was the first person to use camera traps for a scientific survey. So he did a survey, also using a tripwire camera system, to survey large species of animals on the Barro Colorado Island in Panama. So cameras, traps have been around for at least a century, which might leave you asking, why has it taken so long for wildlife ecologists and biologists to catch on to the camera trap wagon? And the reason is there were many technological stumbling blocks to get across first. The first was issues with battery power, cameras just not lasting long enough. The size of the equipment, so this sort of camera size is relatively recent. They used to be very big and very bulky. And most importantly, the trip mechanism, so that trip wire wasn't particularly reliable. So it wasn't until the 1990s that the infrared trigger system came about. And then until the 2000s, when digital cameras became so popular and so affordable. And the combination of these two things, the improved trigger mechanism and digital cameras, have meant that camera traps have now revolutionized wildlife research and conservation. So essentially what you do with a camera trap is you take it somewhere where you want to photograph animals, you attach it to something sturdy to keep it level and stable, like a tree. You tend to want to put them in places where animals are likely to congregate and to visit, like a waterhole, or along a path where animals are likely to walk down or walk past it. You might want to conceal your camera trap a little bit to make it a bit less conspicuous. And then you walk away. That's the camera taking photos of me walking away from the trap. And you hope that in your absence, your camera captures some of the wildlife that are in the vicinity of the particular trap. So these photos weren't taken at that location, which was on Signal Hill, I'm pleased to say. And none of them were taken from the same place. So you're likely to just get whatever is in your general area. Now, camera traps, as I said, they've revolutionized research and conservation. So what have they shown us? One of the most exciting things they've shown us is that they've rediscovered species that were considered extinct in certain places in the world. So one of the most famous examples of this is the wild pygmy hippos. So these are photographs that came out last year of hippos in Liberia, proving that they've survived two civil wars and incredible habitat degradation. Now, a best guess is that there are only 2,000 of these hippos left in the wild, but this really has yet to be verified. And researchers are hoping that the camera trap is the tool that's going to allow them to properly conserve these animals. This is an Amur leopard in China. Now, the interesting thing is that this leopard is considered to be extinct in China. There are only about 50 individuals considered to be alive anywhere, but they're all meant to be found in Russia. So people got very excited when this leopard showed up on a camera trap in China in 2010. And subsequently, the area that the camera trap was placed in has been turned into a national park so that more traps can be put out so they can see if this leopard is indeed an actual Chinese Amur leopard or if it's just come across from the Russian border. This is a hairy-nosed otter. It used to be widely distributed across Asia, but it was poached out. and it hasn't been seen in Malaysia for over a century, until last year, when a photograph was taken, first time in 100 years. And this is a wolverine. If any of you have ever watched X-Men, you'll know about the human version of this animal. Wolverines also used to be abundant across North America and Northern Europe, but because of poaching, hunting, and habitat fragmentation, their ranges have reduced enormously. This was the first wolverine to be photographed in California since 1922, also using a camera trap. And this is a Saharan cheetah. They're different from our common cheetahs down here. They live just in the Saharan belt across the midsection of Africa. And these four photographs were the first images to be taken of these cheetahs in the wild ever. Now again, it's assumed that there are about 250 of them left anywhere, but there's absolutely no way to verify this, except by techniques like the camera trap. So the cameras took photographs of four separate individuals, which has given the researchers hope that they can use this to identify exactly how many are left. And also just to study their behavior. Somehow these animals have adapted to living in an environment that has absolutely no permanent water. And then finally, the Javan rhino. So rhinos obviously are getting a lot of well-deserved attention. This one perhaps needs it more than any of the other species. This is the most critically endangered species of rhino. There are only 40 of them left in the wild, none in captivity. And what's exciting about these photos is that there were two photos taken by WWF of two separate rhino mothers with their calves, showing for the first time that the species is actually breeding in the wild. So there's been rediscoveries using camera traps, but there's also been entirely new discoveries of species, which was quite unexpected. So this Annamite striped rabbit, which occurs on the border between Laos and Vietnam. In 1999, the species was first described after a photo was taken of it using a camera trap. And then a bit closer to home is this very cute grey-faced sengi, which is a type of elephant shrew. Before this photo was taken in 2008, there were only considered to be 15 species of elephant shrew, and the last one was described 120 years ago. So we had to wait more than a century for another species to be described, and it was done so using a camera trap. These are found in south-central Tanzania. Now, a wonderful thing with camera traps is because you remove the human element from the photos, animals are able to behave in the way that they would do naturally without any human interference, which as a baboon ecologist, I know probably better than most people. I've got some videos that I'm hoping are going to play. These were taken by Jeremy, who's sitting at the back. This is now using a video camera trap. And this is an otter in Betty's Bay. Jeremy was describing how the otter sees the camera and has a bit of a breakdown. But he comes back. And it's just lovely to see that animals will identify the camera as something novel, but after a while when they see it isn't a threat, they relax and just behave as they would normally. So that rolling behavior is very normal for otters. And then this is another photo, also another video taken by Jeremy of bat-eared foxes in the Galagadi. Again, you can see how they see the camera as something interesting. They're a little bit more curious than the otter, but braver. Not phased in any way. So not all camera traps have video potential, but for a lot of them, the shutter speed has increased so much that the fastest cameras can now take up to 2 photographs per second. Not all of them are capable of this, but still the frequency at which they can take photos has increased enormously. So you can get lovely montages of animal behavior that you couldn't get before. This is another one of Jeremy's of meerkats also in the Karahari, emerging from their den. And it's just such a lovely surprise to download the images from your camera trap and see everything that's been happening in your absence. Jeremy noticed that, like in his household, the youngsters are the last ones to get up in the morning. And this final sequence is a very fascinating interaction between a leopard and a jackal, a lion and a jackal. I'm not sure what was wrong with this jackal. I suspect something. First and seemed to notice the lion, then seemed to bite him, which didn't go so well for him, as it turned out. Anyway, seemed to end quite well for both, regardless. This is the advantage of placing your camera trap at something like a den or a watering hole where animals are likely to engage with each other and just to be present at all. Then, of course, because the camera is completely indiscriminate of what it takes photos of, you land up having things in your album that you might not necessarily have expected. I haven't put in the naked hikers that Les was telling you about the other day, but that is quite a common affliction for camera trap owners. But something perhaps more useful is pictures of poachers in areas, or suspected poachers. So this is a suspected poacher captured on film in Kenya, wielding his machete down in the bottom. And these are suspected poachers in Nepal. It remains to be seen whether you can actually prosecute anyone based on this evidence, but it might deter people from poaching in an area if they know that something's watching them. And then probably my favorite part is just the wonderful things you see when animals are just animals without humans around. Like this chimpanzee, very curious about the camera trap next to him. This was taken by a second camera trap placed opposite to the one that he's looking in. Primates of all animals are very curious and are likely to pay the most attention to your camera trap. This is a baboon in Kenya who got very up close and personal with a camera placed by a student. And in fact, unfairly, and I say that because I've worked with baboons for a long time, primates are generally the animals most feared by people when it comes to camera traps because they're so agile and dexterous. It's just assumed that they are the ones likely to cause most damage to your equipment. But actually, it's the carnivores you have to worry about. This is a picture taken by the ZSL, who have a camera trap in the Serengeti, of another hyena and her cub. And the quote that accompanies the picture reads, "This is the last photo from our camera trap. Minutes later, it was eaten by the baby hyena." And then this is a lovely image taken in Namibia of a strong male lion walking to where camera trap number one, while his friend in the background makes his escape with camera trap number two firmly in his mouth. So there's very few camera trap owners who don't have a story to tell about animals doing something or other to their camera traps. But it often helps to have two cameras at one time, because at least you have evidence of what happened to the poor camera trap. So camera traps really show us wonderful things and unexpected things. And probably the thing they achieve best is they do so without any human interference. So you really end up with a palpable sense of intimacy with the wildlife that you're observing and that you're capturing. And of course, it's just great fun to leave your camera trap out and see what it captures, download the images later. But more than that, the images have incredible conservation value. Now, camera trapping doesn't come without challenges. One of those is you can't always be certain that you're detecting the animals that are in a given location. So a single camera trap like this one has a field of view, for want of a better phrase, might be the right phrase. So basically, an animal has to walk in front of it in order to be captured within that range. So if any animal walks behind the camera trap, even though it's present, you don't actually detect it there. So you have the chance of falsely saying that these animals don't occur in this area. Now, there are ways of getting around that. The first is, like I say, placing your camera somewhere that it's likely to capture animal movement, like a waterhole or a path. The other way is you leave your camera out for a long time, so you increase the chance of an animal walking past the camera at some point. Or better yet, you have multiple cameras. So you survey an area intensely using a lot of cameras to maximize your chances of capturing whatever's there on camera. Of course, this is very expensive, but with the right collaboration and working together, it's certainly something that's possible. A second problem with camera traps, especially in our country, is theft, either by animals, which people tend to put down to bad luck, or by people, which is the more concerning part. Either way, there are ways of protecting your camera. The first way, or making it less conspicuous, the first way is you can make sure that your camera doesn't have a flash. So you get different kinds of cameras, one that has a flash, which is like this one here, which are very good for taking photographs of animals, particularly at night, and particularly if you want to identify the individuals in the animals. So if you're doing a survey like the Cape Leopard Trust is doing, where they want to know exactly which leopard is where, then you want a flash camera. But if you're just wanting to know that a leopard is there regardless of who it is, then you can get rid of the flash and use an infrared camera. So an infrared camera doesn't flash at all. So the animal or the animal generally is aware of it because I think it smells novel, but humans typically don't recognize infrared photography. Obviously, you lose quality, and the pictures can come out more blurry than they would if you had a flash camera, but it's a risk worth taking to keep your camera safe. Another thing you can do is camouflage your camera, and I'm sure your children and grandchildren will happily help with this. Make your camera look like it's part of the environment that you place it in. There are professional companies that do this as well. Or you can obscure your camera in something that looks like it's meant to be in the natural environment, like a rock or a log. So despite these challenges, camera traps have now or are now being widely used, both for scientific surveys and also because they've turned out to be a wonderful way to engage the public in conservation issues. So it's not surprising that many of the biggest conservation organizations like WWF, Conservation International, are using camera traps as a way to capture information about animal distributions and to engage with the public about conservation issues. And that's exactly what we at the ADU are planning to do for the Mammal Atlas. Oops. Throwing my rings around. So the next part of my talk is telling you specifically about the Mammal Atlas, the where, the how, and the then what of the Mammal Atlas. And firstly, the where. And I think this is something that we are likely to be both widely praised and loudly criticized for, and something that Les and I might both applaud ourselves and hate ourselves for at the same time. But we're forging ahead nonetheless, and for the first time with the ADU Atlas projects, we're extending the Atlas beyond the borders of South Africa and planning to do an Africa-wide Mammal Atlas. Obviously, this is a hugely ambitious project and not one that we can achieve by ourselves. So the next is how we plan to do this. And the first way is through collaboration. So I mentioned there's lots of conservation organizations doing surveys across the world and lots of other local scientists. And our plan is to collaborate with them and to collectively analyze our data together. Already, Les and I have established some contacts with scientists in various countries in Africa who are happy to collaborate with us on the project in principle. In South Africa, in Namibia, Botswana, Angola, Kenya, Tanzania, and Madagascar. Obviously, there's still a lot of gaps to fill, and many of those gaps we plan to fill by collaborating with the bigger organizations that have the finance to survey larger areas of the continent. In addition to this, we're going to be running two of our own camera trap projects. Both of them will be based in South Africa. One will be an intensive survey of the Cape Peninsula, and the second an extensive survey of the Western Cape. The intensive survey, what we plan to do with this is to put camera traps discreetly at very regular intervals across the peninsula and try and verify the distribution patterns of all of the mammal species considered to be present in the peninsula. And this is something we'll be doing in collaboration with Table Mountain National Parks, Nature Conservation Corporation, and local residents. And in fact, anyone is welcome to get involved. I'm not sure exactly the details of how yet, but I will happily let people know. And with the survey, we hope to answer some very important conservation questions for the peninsula. For example, by comparing the diversity and abundance of mammals that we get in natural habitat with urban habitat, we can work out what impacts urban habitat has on mammals, and by the same token, what impact agricultural habitat, like vineyards and plantations, has on mammal abundance and mammal diversity patterns, and what altitudinal patterns we find in terms of mammal diversity and abundance. These are very important questions for managing and conserving animals in the Cape Peninsula, but the answers to them are widely applicable beyond this particular location. Then the second project that we'll be running is the extensive survey, and this is really something being done entirely by the Cape Leopard Trust. And Anita from the Cape Leopard Trust is here today. The Cape Leopard Trust has 4 study sites across the Western Cape, and they have camera trap surveys being conducted in all 4 of them. And already they've recorded over 30,000 images that can be uploaded to to start building a mammal atlas for the Western Cape. Obviously, their focus is leopards, and they've got lots of pictures of leopards, but they've got lots of other pictures of all sorts of mammals in the area that will be wonderful to include in a mammal atlas for the area. So we see these two surveys as being our own personal flagship projects for the mammal atlas to add on to the collaboration with other larger corporations and organizations. But the third and perhaps the most crucial part of the mammal atlas methodology is including citizen scientists into the mammal atlas project. And this is where we differ from all of these other large conservation organizations who typically will only use camera trap photographs from professional scientists for the atlases that they produce or the surveys that they do. And at the ADU, obviously, we widely recognize that the contribution of citizen scientists is critical to the sustainability and to the effectiveness of an atlas project. So we plan to harness citizen scientists as a resource as much as possible. So the way we do this, we're going to encourage citizen scientists to get their own camera traps, if they want to. And the cost varies between $2,000 and $3,000, depending on the kind of camera trap you're wanting. If you want the highest quality, you're looking at about $6,000. You also need two memory cards for the camera trap, so it's about another R200. And then batteries per year, which depending on how frequently your camera is taking photographs and whether it's flash photography or infrared, will chew up the battery either more or less. But in either, you're looking at an average of about R3,000 to run a camera trap for a year, with the major cost being just a one-off cost. And this camera you can then put in your garden, put on your farm, take on holiday with you. They're completely transportable and versatile, so once it's like having any other camera that you would take with you anywhere you go. What we plan to do, but later in the year, is run a mammal atlas roadshow across the country. So try and get as many citizen scientists involved, teach them how to use the camera traps properly, and how to upload their images to our website once they have them. Of course, we don't discriminate purely for camera trap owners. Not everyone can afford one, not everyone wants one. So we happily will accept photographs from people with regular cameras as well. And the important thing is that every camera, every photograph that gets added to the atlas has to have a date attached to it, so we know when it was taken, and has to have a spatial attribute. Without the spatial attribute, we can't include that in any sort of distribution map. And it doesn't matter whether the photographs are current or whether they're from 10 or 20 years ago. As long as each photograph has a date and a spatial stamp, we can still use it. We can filter it however we need to, but we can use all of that information. We also won't discriminate between photographs of live animals and photographs of dead animals. The sad reality is that a lot of roadkill images can contribute very valuably to conservation efforts. So we encourage people who have a strong enough constitution, if you see roadkill on the side of the road and the animal remains identifiable, we'd encourage you to take a photograph, take a spatial point for that animal, and upload that as well. It's real data, it's relevant data that we can use. So once you've got your photographs, however you landed up getting them, the place to send them if you want them to be part of the Mammal Atlas is to the virtual museums of the ADU. That's the website address there. If it's your first time there, you'll have to register. This works the same way for any Atlas project that you want to contribute to, or any virtual museum. Once you've registered, you can log in, and to add images to the Mammal Atlas, you need to click on that little porcupine logo, which it's called VIMMA, the Virtual Museum for Mammals. Once you're inside VIMMA, you'll be led to a screen like this, where you can click the Upload button, and you'll then be prompted through a series of screens telling you how you can upload your images. One of the most important things to fill in, and this is something that you won't be able to upload your images unless you have this information, is the locality of your photograph. As I said, unless the photograph has a spatial reference point, we can't include it in the atlas. There are two ways of adding a spatial reference point. The first is when you're setting up your camera trap or when you're taking a photograph of an animal, if you have any sort of GPS unit with you, just take the GPS coordinate of where you are, make a note of it, and upload that coordinate with the photographs. Of course, if you don't have a GPS with you, that's absolutely fine too. We have an option on the website you'll come to a Google map that will show up, and you can just use the toggle buttons on the right of your screen, left of your screen, to navigate to wherever you took the photograph, zoom into it, and the software will automatically pick up the spatial reference point for wherever you took your photograph. So you really, if all you're armed with is a cell phone, or a point-and-shoot camera, or a disposable camera, or whatever it is you've got, you can still participate in a mammal atlas project. You can take the technology as far as you want and get a fancy camera trap, but it's not necessary. We already have about 70 people registered with the Virtual Mammal Museum and about 3,000 records already uploaded. Obviously, we're looking for lots more. We want as much participation as possible. And we really don't mind what you send in photos of, as long as it's a wild animal, so not a domestic animal and not human. And if in doubt, if you're worried that you're sending in too many impala photographs, don't worry about it. If in doubt, submit. We can always filter at a later stage. The important thing is just to gather as many images from as many locations as possible. Then the second part of our citizen science project is education and outreach. This is something we plan to take very seriously. Getting kids from primary schools and students from high schools involved in the Mammal Atlas project. It's hard to know exactly how we're going to achieve this yet, most likely by aligning ourselves with the current education system and getting sponsorship to fund camera traps for schools or for different areas that we get children involved in. But it's something that we'll be focusing on in earnest. So fine, we're going to land up with a whole lot of mammal photographs, but what do we actually plan to do with them? Well, the first thing we need to do is to identify the animals that are in the photographs. And obviously when you're uploading your own photograph, you can tell us what you think it is. Some of these records, some of the more obscure species, we'll have to verify those records, and some we might have to identify altogether. We've been very fortunate over the last year to have two very dedicated students from the ADU selflessly sacrificing their time to try and identify all the images that are coming in. But as the project grows, we'll need to expand this team considerably. And the way we want to do this is to set up an internship program or a job placement program for newly graduated biology students from university or Technikon, train them up as expert mammal identifiers, get them trained in computer skills, and just start forming a specialist task force to identify all the images that come in. Once we've identified all the animals, we can start building the distribution maps for the species that we have on record. And from there, we'll just be developing maps much like has been done for all the other Atlas projects. We envision that initially we'll be able to develop distribution maps for small, medium to large mammals more easily than other mammals. But over time, as we refine our techniques and expand our methods, we're wanting to include small mammal maps and marine mammal maps as part of the Mammal Atlas as well. Now, one difference between the Mammal Atlas project and the Bird Atlas projects, for example, is the Bird Atlas project were able to generate these wonderful maps of range contraction and range expansion because they have a very long data set. So they have a before and an after, if you will. With the Mammal Atlas, we are really just focusing on the now. So in time, we'll be able to compare this to data that's collected in the future to see how things have changed between now and then. But to make this data immediately useful for conservation, we want to be able to compare it with something else to see whether any range contractions or expansions or shifts have happened now. So we plan to compare the data to the historical distribution data that I was talking about earlier. So this really means comparing it to museum specimens and historical records. And there's actually a wonderful website repository done by Copenhagen University of mammal records, historical mammal records. So they've scoured the literature and put together maps of the historical distribution of several mammal species across sub-Saharan Africa. So already there are websites like that available where we can use that information to compare whatever we get now to that. So the where to from here, as Les said, we have got some funding, but we'll certainly need more funding if we want to run the different aspects of the project, like engaging citizen scientists more and involving schools. So we need to focus on that for the next little while. We need to focus on forming official collaborations with the larger conservation organizations across Africa and with other scientists across Africa. And we need to focus on getting citizen scientists interested in this brand new Atlas project. So we've clearly got a long road ahead of us, but we're very excited and optimistic. And with that, I'll end off, say watch the space, and I'm happy to take any questions, and I'll do my best to answer them. If not now, then at some point in the future. Please do take my email address if you want to get in contact with me about any questions you have beyond today or comments. Thank you.
Thanks, Ali. So in the past 3 days, we've had the Butterfly Atlas, which is a project which is coming to the end of its life cycle. We've had the Bird Atlas project, which is a project which is kind of in the middle of its life cycle. And the Mammal Atlas, which is, you can say, really excitingly, project right at the start of its life cycle. So thank you, Ali, for that wonderful introduction. Questions?
Well, Ed and I have spoken about it. What was quite interesting to me in putting this talk together is I found that camera traps are actually quite good at taking photos of small mammals. I was quite surprised. I think it depends on, these were jumping mice, so I think that helps. That movement was enough for the camera to pick up. But I don't think that'll work for all small mammals. So I think we might have to look at subsampling in different areas using well-known small mammal trapping methods, so Sherman traps or what have you, to see, to catch and release, to see what's there. But this is something that we'll have to develop with small mammal biologists who might have a better idea of a protocol for us to follow. For the Mammal Atlas, we'd actually only need the one, unless it's sort of year after year after year, in which case it does become very interesting for us. But there's actually a student, a PhD student, who'll be working on the Cape Peninsula Atlas with us, who's doing her PhD on otters in the Cape Peninsula. So I must give you her contact details. She runs Otter Watch in the peninsula, and she'll definitely be interested in hearing more about the otter that's visiting.
Because you've chosen the Cape Peninsula and because you use citizen science in the Bird Atlas, I think it would be quite easy to start that, you know, because it's so local.
Yes.
We're not always going to the Serengeti or wherever, but it should be fairly easy to get that bit off the ground.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping. So there's three of us working with Les on the Cape Peninsula project. Two of us have been very involved in baboon world over the last few years, so we have a lot of baboon-interested people interested in the Peninsula Atlas. We have otter people interested now as well, and bird people. So I think it's a perfect place for us to start because of that. And it's probably likely to be the easiest intensive survey that we'll do in possibly the entire project because of that.
And I just yesterday learned about my bird patch, which makes a lot more sense to me than the big habitat. Could you not lower the cameras out so people can put them in their complexes or...
I think it depends on where we land up getting our cameras from. So what we're hoping for the peninsula is that we'll get a large corporation to fund the cameras, in which case we'll be distributing them consistently across the peninsula, and some of those areas might be in people's gardens. And in that case, yes, we could loan them out. If we don't land up doing it that way, we might have to rely on people getting their own camera traps to do it. And as you mentioned, my bird patch, it sprung a thought in my mind that an idea as far as the education programs go is starting a My School Patch project, where the schools put a camera trap on their school property. I don't know if this is feasible, it's just an idea. They put a trap on their property or on a neighbouring school, or schools buddy up, and they start small and see what they have in their area just to spark their interest and enthusiasm.
In the city of Cape Town, 30 or 40 smaller reserves, can you be covering those as well?
Yes, I think what we'd really like to do is to see the difference in mammal diversity and mammal occurrence between something as continuous as the larger sections of the Table Mountain National Park with some of the small reserves that are on the Cape Flats. I think our biggest concern is camera security, and that actually goes across the peninsula. So that's something we'll have to work out before we disseminate cameras. And it also depends on how many we're able to get for this initial survey as to how far and wide we can distribute them.
What will be the Cape, defined as the Cape Peninsula? How far will you go on the flats or what?
That's a very good question. I don't know. Yeah.
No, will it be the city of Cape Town as the city of Cape Town, which is like, you know, 4.5 million people, that area, or will it be just the Table Mountain from Lion's Head to Cape Point?
Yeah, it might end up being something in between. It becomes quite quite arbitrary to define a line down the middle of the Cape Flats, so it would have to be a...
Yeah, I mean, if you go for the city of Cape Town, then you could include all the smaller nature reserves as well on the Cape Flats, and, you know, as far as Somerset West and whatever.
I think that's a lovely idea. Definitely look at that, yeah.
I think it's astonishing to say how poorly we know the mammals of the Cape Peninsula. Right, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely right. I mean, from my own experience, the things people told me about baboons before I started baboons, compared to what we know about baboons now, is astonishing. And they're the most commonly seen species of mammals on the peninsula. So I think there's so much that we don't know. For instance, where are the caracals, and are they Cape foxes, and are they breeding, and are they not? And it's amazing what we actually don't know for this hotspot of biodiversity. Yeah, no, I think it's going to have wonderful knock-on effects like that. I think our bigger concern is, and Les was talking about this the other day, is species sensitivity. I think we'll have to be a bit cautious about what information we put out and how much. But obviously, bird clubs and friends groups in different residential areas, if people get involved in those sort of societies, then we can share data a bit more freely. Which are very...
Not a question, an observation.
It's close. It's at a research site called Ngiwa, I think, in Namibia. Yeah.
We saw something rather similar to that.
I think there wasn't a line involved. The jackal came down to drink in a mountain called a trough, and he walked up to the trough and just went straight into the trough. Right. We never saw him again, and we inquired after him, and he was told that he was a rabbit. Well, that's what we thought. Yeah. Yeah. When I showed this to my ex-supervisor, who's a behavioral ecologist, that was his first comment, either blind or rabbit. And I've heard of jackals doing this with giraffes and doing quite strange things, so it's very possible.
Well, tomorrow, after Peter's lecture, we've arranged to actually do a live demonstration. We'll have access to the internet. We'll actually do a demonstration of how to load pictures onto the virtual museum. We can't be long, so it'll only be a 15-20 minute demonstration. We won't be dragging on for hours and hours, because there's another function on with us soon afterwards. So after tomorrow's lecture, or Peter's lecture, very quickly, we'll do a full demonstration of how you actually upload. Any of the virtual museums, it's the same protocol for all of them. And as Tully says, you need to register. You need to register as an ADU observer. And the advantage of that for the observers is that you just have to log in, and then you don't have to give all your details every time you log in, because that information is all in the system. So that actually makes the upload process much faster. for everyone involved. So we'll do that after tomorrow's lecture. And the background that Tully has shown you is various screenshots. You'll actually see them online on the website. It's a really quick and simple and easy process. So, thank you very much, Tully, for that introduction to the Mammal Atlas, which is a flagship new project of the AUU Planning for the Future. It's actually, say one more thing, it's actually astonishing that we've done the bird atlas has been done, the ruddy frog atlas has been done, the butterfly atlas has been done, reptile atlas has been done, but the most charismatic group of animals of all in the country has not been tackled, and that's the mammals. So that's the one which, with great bravado, is the right word, with the great, with the background of experience with the other projects, we are tackling with some confidence. We look forward to the next few years with the cutting. Thanks, Tully.
Can I just ask if anyone is interested in being involved in the Cape Peninsula project? I can either write your email down, or won't you please just pop me an email and I'll add you to our mailing list and then we can communicate from there.
Can I do for your extensive one?
Yes, anything, anyone, yeah. Yeah, that would be lovely. Yeah. Great, thanks.
And if you have photos from your trip to the Kalahari Park, upload those as well. Thank you.
Keep images from webcams. You know, a lot of places have webcams. You know, the Kruger and Tosha and everything. Well, no, they have the live webcam, don't they, on the water course. Now, is there any way of capturing those images? We don't want them all.
No, but if you can get a section of the video and you can just record
them. That may be whoever supervises it can send you the interesting ones. There's other people now go on their computer and watch.
I've seen some of your photos. Oh, thank you.
Is this without a battery?
Yeah. But the battery's even there, it's not very heavy. They're just the
I just wanted to ask, do you know if anybody doing any work on porcupines?
Yes,
Christy Bragg. B-R-A-G-G.
Yes. She's doing up in Nivodrome, so not in the peninsula. What are you looking for?
I've just got them coming in and I just want to know more.
Christy absolutely loves porcupines, and she's been doing her PhD on them for a long time, and she would love to answer your questions. Do you want me to give you a happy little address? She should be on the ICT.
How do you spell Christy?
C-H-R-I-S-T-Y. .brag.ICT. If you struggle, just send me an email and I'll look it up.
Thank you, Jess.
I'll give you the categories.
Yes.
Are you starting on it?
Yes.
Would you accept panda records?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's people really involved.
The only way where I live, it's mostly grassland, so I have to cap them.
But when it comes to the virtual museum project, that's only with internet, because it includes a photo.
But actually,
you just can't accept it. Other records. It's interesting.
It would be wonderful. I think our biggest problem with running a big project is that we just don't have the manpower.
Those records are computerized.
Yes. But it's certainly something you can't have around office without small mammals there. So it's definitely something we'd want to include. I just don't think the techniques that we're pushing now are the ones that are going to be particularly helpful. But I think.
If we use the Cape Peninsula
project as a starting block, and I'll call Gary Farnett
is there any?
So Gary Brown is asking me more.
Send the data or whatever. So what I'm trying to say is most of
our
I'm connected with the observatory in Observatory, the South African Astronomical Observatory. It's a 25-acre going hectare site within the Two Rivers Urban Park. And I know one of our the people who lives on the site has one of these cameras, and he's been playing around with it and trying to see what he can. So I don't know whether, I mean, I'll certainly give him your contact information. So I suppose you'll be probably getting in touch with the Two Rivers Urban Park and people or the observatory.
Yeah, all smart parks do. But that would be wonderful if I'll
do that. So I think he'd enjoy participating.
It's such fun. So I think everyone enjoys it. Yeah, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, we tell you. This project. Can use these ways on something that happens when people do come involved.
And we'll really exclude all the people who are going to give paper reports by saying, well, you can only enter by registration.
You've excluded. What I'm saying is, if someone says, I want to become involved, we'll say, well, these are the requirements. Are you able to fulfill those requirements? If not, then let's talk and see if there's a way around it. And there may be. So even if we say internet's the way to do it, if you say, I've got these lists and lists and doing that, then we say, wow, that's impressive. Let's make a plan. We'll get a student to enter them. It's only after discussion that
I think it would be useful just to tell people. That they can actually come down and talk about other ways of getting things set at the moment. We don't know that. Who has all the data? Has everything been consolidated now basically in your ADU? All your building groups and so on. Or are there things sitting in other parts of the university at the moment? I submitted every day during that season. And I gave my whole set, maybe basically.
I know, it's a good street or something like that. It's one of those.
I was just interested in knowing what it's called.
Unfortunately, a lot of early data.
Have you ever seen one of how it actually works? It's not a flash at all.
We have an ADUI to computerize as much as possible.
Yes. I know some
things that we flash
a job around the holidays and flash it back to the police. No, well, thanks very much indeed. This has been interesting. Obviously, one would like to get involved in this.
Just incidentally, coming back to other questions, that's the reason why we want, as far as possible, everything to come down by internet immediately, because it can be saved and archived so easily.
Oh, sure.
And it reduces the chances of it being lost.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that it's around, even in 50 years' time, or we're not around, that it's still data that people can use.
One of the things yesterday, were you yesterday?
But I know about some of the talks, so I've heard those talks.
Obviously you know what goes on. And I was interested in those Pinto squares that you now reduce it down to 8.9 kilometer square. I looked at the one that was put up on the screen. And in fact, it went basically from the least practical at one side, all the way through up to basically the top of Table Mountain. Now, if you think of that, I try and read really every weekday, week I'm up in the morning. But it's not in front of me. Okay, so I come back to the meeting and all I'd end up with is a few grass birds, perhaps the old brown woodpecker would do. You know, it's not a hell of a lot up there. Whereas someone else needed to do regular walks, because they have a dog, and another one is different by their expected. So you come up with a different suite of birds. Other ones go into numerous forests. So you end up either with a plantation or they go home and you've got natural forest. So all those people have their regular walks, their regular things, and they're going to come up with a different suite of
Brambles.
Yeah.
When someone takes off Sabbath 2, the Atlas project, you ask them as far as possible to cover all habitats. The first two hours you need to go from the Lisbon all the way to the mountain. Then we'll average out to the correct answer. If it was a remote place and you're only doing part of it, then it would be a fine. But it's still correct in that those species are in their habitat. It's just not the only species in their habitat. So that's why covering all the different habitats in the continent is important. The atlases that are regular atlases are covering the whole situation. We've got a 5-block area, so if you go for a walk today and you go for a walk tomorrow, you may not submit two lists. It has to be combined into one day. Up to 5 days. Then you can start your notes. So what it means is at least it gives you opportunity. In those 5 days, you might actually just once go to the Lisbon River, even though you like walking up the mountain. And then you add a few birds from there, and it gives you a broader coverage. So we have thought all these things through.
Yeah.
Means it's a balance of having a protocol that is scientifically acceptable and one that people are able to cope with. But the key people, they want to. They want to go to every corner of the pentad because they want to get as many birds as possible. And it's their passion to record every bird as possible. So that's different to someone who's walking and wanting to contribute. It's different to someone who wants to contribute and you'll go walking.
First of all, I think we can identify all the various habitats. You can say, right, that we're in sandy bush, we're in plantation, we're in Afro-montane forest, we're on a dam, we're on a stream or waterway. Fairly easy in the peninsula or somewhere to come up with, let's say, 2 or 3 dozen different habitats. And the person then says, I was only in this habitat, or I only went to those 2 habitats out of a possible 6 in that pentad. And I think,
I'll repeat, that's acceptable, but it's not preferred. We do want people to go to all habitats as possible. It's provision, it's marked. To say, I did not go to all the habitats. And from the species list, we can actually tell you which habitats you went to. If you say, I saw a Levanon cisticula, a cape river, a cape river, I'll say, oh, you walked along the Lisbon River. If you say, oh, I saw an orange-breasted sunbird, a cape sugar bird, a cape canary, I'll say, oh, you walked on the concho. I can tell you which habitats you went to without you telling me.
Okay, you can tell me that. That's not going to pick up any differences if suddenly you find that things are moving. You are not getting these differences up. You're making assumptions. You're making an assumption that you're
using lots of data. We're not using one list. One list is and I'm using a combination of factors. If you say for one bird, I might not be able to tell you where you went. If you tell me all the birds that you saw in one habitat, then I can tell you that's the habitat you were in because those birds are good. There might be one that doesn't fit, and then I'll say, you walked along the list and you saw a cape. Chaffinch. That doesn't fit the habitat, then it's a vagrant, or you did
go somewhere else as well, and not just the
Okay.
No, I appreciate that point. The second question that I think says, every single individual that you've got here has different early skills, not only the experience, but also their cut-off point.
You ever see the pictures of...
I've got a quick glance at that, Michael, I think.
Yes.
Had a fork tail, fairly large raptor. I think I can see a yellow bill. It must be a yellow bill kite. But it isn't necessarily a yellow bill kite. But some people will jump to a conclusion, and other people won't. They'll put it down as unidentified or dubious. Now, do you bring that into your category, the ability of your different birders?
No, that's the
problem. When someone actually registers,
you screen them in some way.
Oh, well, this is right.
To know
if you can go on to the other thing. You can't just send a list without being registered.
It's fascinating to see.
Tell us who you are. Yes. And we don't ask anything about initially about your register. We will then tell you the protocol. The protocol is a vast issue of your identification. You might see, and I have experienced this, I've done an Atlas card, and then we record, say, 30 or 40 birds, and then you say, fine, I'm 100% sure. Yeah, I actually There's no provision to say, we don't want that information. We know that you didn't see everything. No one can see every bird in every canter. Anyway, there'll be some bird that's hiding stock. That's okay, we work on
the order of the very positive identification.
You can't accept and the other thing is, you record making stuff. Two options. You're going to say there's a verbal kite from an area and time of year where the kite is from the time of will say that is a record against what we know from the so if it's a record from outside that's distribution, we'll send an email and send confirmation. Often, people reply back and say, oh, yeah, sorry, I actually just made a typing mistake. And he's fixed it in this list. Or it can be, so that's if it's outside his record, can be similar. If by mistake said Kate Bulbul and you didn't see one, it's from an area where it's very common. We won't pick that up. You won't pick that up. But actually, because it could have been there. So we don't want that kind of error, but the reality of life is there will be a few errors like that. Actually, it's not going to fail like that, especially for lots of records. It means an effective size of those goes away, percentage, less than 1%. We just do the best we can. Know that there are errors. That's the reality. Humans make errors, full stop. But we do the best we can.
Okay, well, thanks very much indeed.
Are you just casually
interested? I was in the zoo department for 27 years.
What were you?
Marine ecologist. But I started off on birds. In fact, I started off with long brocaded and livers. I was still at school and they got these bird counts and so on. We did counts on the East Big River, counts at Daphne and Zurich Farm, counts up in Kirstenbosch. And I sort of cycle up at 6 o'clock in the morning, go and do a bird count, go back, shower, and then go off to school. Yeah, those sort of things. I started off a long time ago. But since then, A lot of time at sea as a marine ecologist, and I kept up a lot of things. I was just interested to know whether these things had been incorporated.
I think so, because as far as I know, busy computerizing seabird calls from the Fitzpatrick.
Oh, really?
And we've got a seabird atlas, which I don't know if David mentioned yesterday or not, because it's very special. It's for seabird experts who go out on boat trips. Most people aren't going to be going on boats and
conferences. It is a specialized thing.
It's very specialized, but it's where people are going up and recording current
yes.
records, but you're also wanting these historical records
yes.
to report these market changes.
Yeah.
And we've got a student who's visiting those right now, so that could include your cards.
Yeah, anyhow, I'm just interested in getting back into disability again.
Do you have internet at least?
Myself. My wife has as well. And I'm just
interested. No, it's a fair question.
Because, for example, I'm in the mountains, I have been for years, and I do a lot of sort of hiking and climbing. And what amazes me is people who are in the mountains, like Claudia, you may be a member yourself, are all highly educated people with professional backgrounds and so on. But you find that probably 30% of them don't have cell phones and they don't have internet. They say, well, actually, life goes on, you don't actually need that stuff. You don't want to complicate things anymore. So here you've got good people who could be good information, but they don't have the means of getting it across.
But not only that.
So this is where the sort of question of purpose is.
Just interest, we'll make a plan.
I don't know what interest is in this group here, but I think it is something which we might just mention it at our group here. Good. Yeah, my name is Peter. Peter's up here. Peace out.
I have been visited by the but I actually have to do I love the little bit I did. You know what happens is that I kind of don't know such a lot. And you come out and the rest of your life just happens to you.